We're in the library of Yale University Press for episode 5 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. I'm Peter Moore, and this is Travels Through Time. In today's episode, I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Waters about the strange and surprising art of witchcraft and how it endured as a belief system right into our modern age. Mix a little of the cow's hair and blood with salt and gunpowder, stuff it in a bladder, and incinerate it on a fire made of green ashen wood. As it burns, pronounce these words. I confine all evil and enemies of mine and of my cattle into the fire forever, never to hurt me nor mine forever. In the name of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Amen. These might sound like words plucked from the 16th or 17th centuries, but instead they come from a pamphlet that was in general circulation in the West Country of England in the mid-19th, long after the Enlightenment and modernity were supposed to have swept superstition away. Today's guest on Travels Through Time is going to take us on a tour back to see this very different side to the Victorian world. Dr. Thomas Waters is a lecturer in modern history at Imperial College in London, where he teaches the invigoratingly titled module Spellbound, A History of Magic from Ancient Times to the Present Day. In August, his fabulously researched and nimbly written new book, Cursed Britain, was published. I met Thomas in Bloomsbury the other day to talk our way through one year in this intriguing history. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Thomas.
Thank you, Peter. Good afternoon and hello, listeners.
Okay, let's begin with a general chat, I think, about witchcraft and magic. I'm guessing that we're looking at some really deep histories here.
Yes, witchcraft's been with humanity since ancient times. If you go back, you know, thousands of years ago to ancient Egypt, you can find what people would call voodoo dolls and, you know, things that people have been used to try and harm their enemies with by sort of sticking pins into effigies and that kind of thing. And the history of witchcraft permeates human history. You can find it across the world and, you know, from ancient times to the present day.
Is there any particular object, I'm thinking, which excites historians like you of ancient magic? And any, I don't know, have you got any ancient voodoo dolls from Egypt which have been turned up in the pyramids or anything like that?
I don't personally. It's a funny thing, actually, studying the history of witchcraft and magic. I came to the topic as a sort of arch rationalist, a sort of 100% skeptic and hostile to magic, if I'm completely honest. But the subject kind of stays with you. It sort of haunts you a bit. And I must admit, having studied this now and having researched it for about 15 years, you can now find, although I don't really class myself as a believer, you can now find a few good luck charms and a few healing crystals and that sort of thing around my house. I don't want to give you the impression that I've got too many eccentric views. I don't have any ancient objects, but okay. I do have some modern ones.
Well, it'd be good if you had some ancient Egyptian voodoo doll. I suppose you'd probably be known for that. I suppose one of the things you write about right at the beginning is investigating black magic is difficult because of the very nature of it, which witchcraft is secretive, conspiratorial, and people dislike talking candidly about it, and they'll often not write things down if they are doing them. So you mentioned there that you've been 15 years going through the archives and keeping your eyes open for more information about this. Has this been a constant challenge for you?
Yes, it has. It's been quite a journey, really. I began the study of witchcraft and magic when I was an undergraduate at Leeds University, and I was looking at sort of what you might call folklore in the Victorian period. I was looking at folklore on the Welsh border through the diaries of a particular clergyman, a chap called Francis Kilvert. And it was a very interesting side of Victorian life that I hadn't seen before. You know, I was used to the history of political reform and economic change and modernisation in Victorian England, so it was remarkable to find that many people's lives were coloured by these sort of events, seeing the spirits of people who had recently departed, or, you know, believing that their misfortunes were caused caused by the evil magic of others. So that's where all...
So what age was this clergyman?
It was in the 1870s. This guy, Francis Gilbert, he wrote this incredible diary. It's sort of really vivid diary, and you can get an abridged version and a sort of fairly full version of it now. Unfortunately, the manuscript doesn't survive because he had, I think he had quite a lot of affairs, and when he died young. His wife burnt the manuscript, alas.
Oh well, it's lost to us, I suppose, but perhaps cheered his wife up at the time. But this idea, I think you touch on it right there. We're in the 1870s. We imagine this to be the kind of great age of machines and science and rational progress, etc. Mm. And one of the key things about your whole project is this idea that witchcraft and supernatural belief did not end with the Enlightenment in the, you say, mid-18th century, but it endured for a lot longer. That's right, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people who enjoy Victorian history and who have read about Victorian history will be astonished about the amount of witchcraft in this period. People are familiar with the occult revival of the later 19th century with mesmerism, spiritualism, theosophy and other movements like that. But I don't think there's much knowledge of how many people, when times got hard, when things went bad, when they lost their job, when they started to get ill and when they couldn't find a solution to these problems, how many people started to begin to wonder and almost to make themselves believe that they were actually, that they were cursed, that somebody was wishing them ill.
The other thing which struck me reading through was really you find across the strata of society, so this is not just what you would call a popular superstition.
Yeah, that's right.
Among the kind of lower classes, like, and we could use all sorts of slightly prejudiced terms of the illiterate, ignorant, uneducated. You can almost conjure up a picture of some rural farm labourer, you know. You're finding examples of clergymen who are interested in this, and rich merchants, etc.
Yeah, doctors, businessmen, businesswomen. That's right. I must admit, when I, for several years actually, after I'd begun studying this topic, I think I was a bit too trusting in the contemporary reports on witchcraft, which tended to suggest that the only people that believed seriously in witchcraft were raw folks, rustics, hodges, as sort of was the generic rustic character they used to. That's the name they use in the Victorian period. Raw folks and the labouring classes, you know, to use a term from the 19th century. But when you start to really investigate, that isn't the case, actually. It's quite surprising. And, you know, amongst middle-class people, upper-class people, wealthy people, they were very embarrassed about this. It was very sort of stigmatised way of thinking. But there were certainly some, and they're reported in the newspapers and in other sources from the period, there were certainly some very well-to-do people, and when things went wrong for them, they started to wonder, you know, actually, are there dark forces at work in my life?
We're going to talk about a few of these now, and in particular, three different events. But first, we like to focus in on one year. And before we get to that year, let's just do a bit of chronological nuts and bolts. So you've got the crime of witchcraft, which, if we think back to, I don't know, the idea of the Tudors burning witches at the stake, that was abolished.
Mostly hanging them as well.
Yeah, and hanging them. Yeah. But that went in 1737 as a statute.
That's right, yes.
So we progress into the Victorian era and we get to the year which you've chosen, 1862. Just tell us what's going on in 1862. This is beyond the world of witchcraft. What's happening in the world?
It's the time of the American Civil War and the cotton famine. It might sound odd to mention when we're talking about Britain to begin with the American Civil War, but it's having a massive impact on economic life in Britain. There was a recession going on and cotton was very expensive, raw material coming into the country, so it was causing great economic problems, particularly in the west of England and around Lancashire. At the same time, a lot of the things I suppose we'd associate with the modern period, a lot of the things that we still have from the Victorian era and that we still value now were being created around this time. The first professional football club was established in this year, Notts County. The first underground railway would be built in London the year after in 1863. They're all the sort of things you'd expect of the Victorian era, all the impressive industrial and scientific things. In 1862, for instance, there was an industrial and scientific exhibition held in South Kensington. So it was a, you know, it was a sort of a time of Victorian modernity and progress and economic booms and busts. And at the same time, there was this other aspect of life as well, this hidden aspect of people's experiences and thoughts.
I suppose it'd be remiss of me to not point out that the first weather forecast came in 1861, the year before, which is kind of interesting in this context because it's a kind of science, I suppose, trespassing into ground that was once occupied by superstition and folklore. and things like that.
Yes, I dare say there were still people, and there definitely were, people using weather omens and, you know, and what have you at the same time.
Okay then, all right, so let's have a look at some different scenes. I will say one last thing. This is a quote from your book, which I really liked. And it's actually from 1857, but it sets the scene. And it's a writer for the Saturday Review. And he writes that in every quarter of England, we find not the lingering and the moribund, but the active influence of witchcraft at work. Let's go and find them. So, scene number one. We're back in 1862 now. Could you tell me where you'd like to go?
Yes, I'd like to go to a remote district north of Hadrian's Wall, to the most southerly of the Hebridean Islands of Scotland, to a little island sometimes called the Wee Isle, and its name is pronounced Gia.
So what happened there at that time, which is connected to your story of witchcraft?
In the spring of 1862, in Gia, a small farmer, a chap called James Smith, he was getting up one morning, getting up to go and check on his valuable livestock. Most people in Gia were either farmers, they sort of had some potatoes and turnips, and mostly it was the dairy industry, or they were fishermen. And he left the door of his cottage and he looked out over his yard, he looked out towards his stables where all his valuable livestock were. But this morning in spring 1862, James saw something unusual and something very different by the door of his stable. With the rising sun, he saw a figure. He was shocked and he was angry about this, because why would somebody at 7 o'clock in the morning be trespassing on his farm, just be there standing by his valuable livestock? Who could it be? Could it be somebody interfering with his animals? He didn't know, so he was very angry about this. He bent down to pick up a tool to go and threaten and shout at this woman. But when he looked up again with the tool in hand, the woman was no longer there. Instead, he could just see a hare pacing away over the dewy grass out of distance. So he whistled to his dog. He told it to give chase, but the hare managed to get away. That was a story, in fact, that James Smith told around Gia. He told this story in the tavern. He told this story to the ferryman. He told this story in the cottages of his friends. And this story that many of you might think is, you know, a strange story, a sort of incomprehensible story, this story elicited a powerful, you might even say terrified, reaction. Some people told him to hold his tongue. Some people couldn't stand to listen to this story. What this story was alluding to was a power witches were believed to have, to be able to shapeshift into the form of sneaky, nimble, often nocturnal animals, particularly hares.
Wow. So a few things there. Because this is incredibly vivid, this story. And it obviously seems to have caught the imaginations of people in the locality very quickly. Can I ask you, just first of all, one thing I noticed when reading through, you note that in Scotland there was much higher, I think, convictions for witchcraft than in England.
Yes,
is that suggestive of stronger supernatural belief in the north of the islands?
Well, it may well be reflect a high level of witchcraft belief. That's something I'm a bit tentative about, you know, or whether the state pursued witches with more
Well, that was
vigor.
My first contextual question, because you've given us a really vivid picture of the scene, as I said, and whether James Smith was just another, or was there something really weird about this? What made it different to other reported sightings of witches?
What made it different was James Smith told this story, spread this story around the island, and as you say, Peter, it spread like wildfire. Before long, people were saying they thought they knew who this woman was. They thought it wasn't just a sort of anonymous character, that they knew the name of this woman, and she was a farmer. She was a very quite a wealthy lady by the standards of Gia, in fact, quite a prosperous woman called Catherine McGowan. They started to say it to Catherine's face. They started to accuse her of being a witch, of causing problems, of causing misfortunes for their neighbours. And Catherine endured these innuendos, endured a reputation being traduced for quite some time, actually, for almost a year. And eventually this got too much. She just couldn't endure it any longer. About 9 months, a bit longer, about 10 months after this story had first been spread around by James Smith, Catherine decided to sue him. She decided she'd had enough of people saying that she was a shape-shifting witch, she was causing misfortunes, it was making her life so miserable that she was going to go to a lot of trouble. She was going to get the ferry across to the mainland Scotland, down to Campbelltown, where the local court was, and she was going to sue James Smith for damages, for putting it about that she was a witch, because it had been so harmful to her. The reputation of a witch that she gained was very damaging for her, very harmful for her, inescapable, really, on a little island like that. So that's what makes this story different, that, you know, there were people, thousands, accused of doing similar things in Victorian Britain, of shape-shifting into witches. But Catherine was somebody who suffered so much, was so upset, and had the means to kind of try and fight back as well, that she decided to bring a lawsuit against James Smith. And that's why we know so much about this case. We know so much about what all the different people of Gear used to talk about, used to say about witches. We know all sorts about their reactions to this story.
So that's fascinating from an archival point of view, because it gives you such a level of access into people's thoughts and beliefs and so on. One of the things that you state there, which kind of strikes me as a bit different, is the fact that she was a respectable woman of maybe some status on the island. Because reading through, you know, lots of the cases you mention in the book, the people who seem most vulnerable to being accused of being a witch or a wizard or whatever are these peripheral characters. You know, the person who goes door to door selling, the peddlers, the people who in other ways are undesirable for the community, and they're quite easy to accuse of things. This is a bit strange, isn't it? Because she seems, from your description, to be, what, a farmer's wife?
That's right, yes. Catherine and her husband, James, they lived in, by the standards of Gear, a nice farm. It cost about £150 a year to rent their farm, which was as much as sort of a fairly senior civil servant in London was earning. And it was about five times as much as this fellow, James Smith, who besmirched her, paid for his farm. So, you know, James Smith, you can imagine, he probably lived in a farm with a thatch roof, whereas Catherine lived in a much nicer farm, one of the few buildings in Gear with a slate roof. You know, she would have had more food and, you know, more comfortable conditions, more servants and what have you. We shouldn't get preoccupied with the image of the outsider witch, of the beggars and the impoverished people living on the fringes of communities who were scapegoated for spellcasting. That did happen. They weren't the only people who were accused of witchcraft in the Victorian era. I mean, if I can just sort of widen my remarks just for a moment. Amongst the hundreds of reputed witches, alleged witches that I managed to identify from the Victorian newspaper archive, a good deal of them were actually related to the victims. So it wasn't just a way of scapegoating people you didn't already like. You know, people didn't really want to say that their sister or their mother or their aunt or their grandmother was a witch, but they ended up thinking this way and almost sort of making themselves a...
I'm wondering whether, is there a kind of gender part to this, where it was a way of destroying a woman who was inconvenient to you or you've had an argument with or something like this? If you accuse someone of being a witch, even in this time, I imagine that happens more, for example, just statistically, than accusing a man of being a wizard. Is that right?
It is right, yes. In Britain in the early modern period, around 90% of the people that were accused of witchcraft were women. And that statistic remains the case in the Victorian era. About 90% of the reputed witches that you can identify from the newspapers were also women. It's a very curious thing, though, and very hard to explain that preponderance. And I think one can see the difficulties when you sort of begin to zoom out a bit and look more widely. Because in places like in Normandy, in France, for instance, in the early modern period, most witches were accused witches were men. And that remained the case throughout the 19th century. And in fact, there's an incredible anthropological study of witchcraft in Normandy in the late 1960s, early 1970s, a book called Deadly Words. And that confirms that it was still the case that most witches were men there. So it isn't always the case that women are the primary focus of witchcraft accusations. So I'm a bit sceptical of trying to explain this, the preponderance of women as witches, just trying to sort of attach it to misogyny and to attacks on women. I think it's something more to do with sort of the legacy of folklore, the legacy of the myths. Sort of people just remember the stories from the past. These conventions have been established in the early modern period.
So it's carrying forward from one generation to the next,
exactly,
which has a role as well. Well, Catherine, then, we should probably follow her story through, because my hunch is that she didn't actually turn herself into a hare and scamper away. Do we know what happened to her? Or did she disappear once again?
Yes, we do. The court case Catherine initiated in 1863 went on for almost a year and a half. It was a constant stream of appeals and counter-appeals. You know, she was initially successful, and then James Smith, who'd sort of started spreading this story, appealed, and then he was successful. And then it involved the judge in Campbelltown trying to come to a very serious view about what it would mean to be accused of witchcraft on an island like Gia. He'd been using documents like the statistical account of the island, a sort of an official survey of island life that had been published in 1845, and he'd initially concluded that witchcraft, being accused of being a witch on Gear wasn't too serious, because look here in the statistical account, almost everybody can read. Surely it's not a serious thing if this is a sort of well-educated island. But it wasn't the case. When he ended up hearing the testimony of the various islanders of how frightened they were about witchcraft and how they wouldn't want to get too involved with these kind of people that had these reputations. He ended up concluding that, yes, Catherine had suffered greatly, and although he didn't think that her suffering merited the £200 she'd asked for, he actually just awarded her £10 in damages. It was still a victory, but alas, even that wasn't to be, because James Smith's lawyer, he actually had a look through the Witchcraft Act that you mentioned earlier, the 1736, that had repealed the crime of witchcraft and instead created a new crime of pretences to magic. And it actually said in one of the clauses that no longer could anybody be sued for accusing someone of witchcraft as well. So ultimately, you couldn't be incriminated for accusing someone of witchcraft. That was the law of the land. And so after appealing to a higher court in Edinburgh, James Smith got off, and poor old Catherine, yeah, she just had to go back and, I'm afraid, make the best of it on gear. It must have been very hard, inescapable, really, from this reputation.
It's quite an attractive image, isn't it? This hair dashing off, like the idea of shape-shifting. I think we're all seduced by these, you know, the richness of the storytelling.
Yes, and there's something slightly enchanting about it, isn't there, that stays with you.
Well, I mean, even as you described it then, you think, wow, that's a bit of a story, and then, like, kind of to disprove it destroys the story, and therefore...
Yeah, that's why, I guess that's why so many people tell the story. I mean, in his testimony, when they finally got James Smith in court, he actually said he didn't even believe in witchcraft. Whether or not one actually accepts his word there is, you know, whether you should, I'm not sure, but he certainly enjoyed telling the story, and a lot of other people enjoyed telling the story. Indeed, these kind of stories were told not just across Scotland, across England, across Britain, but much wider. You can find these similar tales in Ireland, in Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Germany, Austria. The kind of the theme, the motif of the witch hair is a very potent one, a very widespread one.
Well, we're roaming widely, but I'm going to bring you back to our year, which is 1862. We've looked at that one particular case. Now we're going to look at another. We're going to move from Britain's Celtic fringe to the heart of metropolitan London, maybe not too far from where we are at the moment. Mm. It's quite a specific location you've given us, 31 Charles Street, Westminster. The date is the 13th of April, and it's 1862 again. What's happening? Why do we want to be there?
It's going to be the scene of a terrible crime. Charles Street, Westminster, it's within view pretty much of the Houses of Parliament. A lot of fine Georgian buildings that were constructed in the 1750s. It leads up to Berkeley Square, and we're high up in one of these sort of 3-4-storey Georgian buildings. And inside this room, there's an elderly lady, a lady named Mary King, and she's a 74-year-old grandmother, and she's having a lunch. And then, all of a sudden, she hears the handle turn at the door. The door opens, and in comes her grandson. Her grandson's a chap called Charles Telbrook. He's 27 years old. He's a collar maker, which unsurprisingly means that he makes collars. He's a retired soldier, and he's somebody that's been having a bad time of it. He's been quite depressed. He's not really wanted to work, that kind of thing. He lets himself, he doesn't knock, he tries the lock. He walks into this room. He goes straight over to his grandmother, and he's holding a razor. Gets the razor, and he starts slicing it around her head, on her forehead. He pushes her over. She tries to protect herself. She sort of pulls the table over and tries to sort of block Charles with the table. But he picks up a stick and he starts bashing her around the head. And then eventually, neighbours come, and then the police are called, the police arrive. And Charles says some interesting things. He says, "I wasn't trying to kill her. I'm not trying to run away. I just wanted to break the power that she had over me."
Well, barbaric is the immediate response anyone would have. But obviously, there's a lot of theory going on. There's a lot going on which we need to explain. Was this similarly a sensational case when it came into the public sphere?
He wasn't just trying to cause the maximum pain, Charles, on his grandmother Mary. What he was trying to do was draw the witch's blood, this woman who he believed had bewitched him. Like a lot of other people in Victorian Britain and in earlier periods, he believed that you could break the power of a spell if you managed to draw the witch's blood. And that's what he was trying to do. This technique was supposed to be more potent if you did it above the mouth, above the breath, on the head, which is why he did that. But then I suppose once he'd carried out this ritual attack, presumably he'd been feeling very bitter and angry, you know, in the belief that his grandmother had been bewitching him and making him depressed and whatnot.
I suppose it's a kind of very disturbing thought to feel, like, within you.
Yeah.
That something is wrong and, you know, that it can't be explained by any rational sense. And so this is a clear inference of what you're telling me, that this Charles Telbrook was feeling. Is that correct?
It is, yes. People like Charles, they didn't just jump to the conclusion when the first thing went wrong that they were bewitched, when they lost their job, or when they got ill, or when their relationship broke up, or whatever. People typically tried to deal with these problems in normal ways. You know, if their animals got ill, they went to the vet. If they got ill, they'd go to the doctors. If they lost their job, they'd try to get another one. But if they couldn't solve their problems with conventional, normal, you might say rational remedies, then people started to wonder, you know, actually, is there something else at work here? Then that's when people might start to think, actually, have my seemingly unrelated misfortunes got a common origin in witchcraft? And that's what happened to Charles Tilbrook. He was well aware of how everybody else would see his thoughts and his actions. In court, when he was tried, he said, you know, people don't believe in witchcraft today, they're too enlightened for that, but I believe in it.
I'm trying to rationalise his process. It's difficult for us to do, I suppose, at this distance of time, although maybe people do believe they're bewitched at the moment.
They do.
I'm sure they do. But the centering of his focus on his grandmother seems a bit peculiar, because, like, obviously we don't make it a habit of attacking family members.
Indeed.
Like, kind of an elderly grandmother is often like the typical member in a family who should be loved beyond all others. What was it about Mary King? Do we know anything about their relationship in specific that might explain why he... Because anyone could have bewitched him if he's bewitched. It could have been probably a much more anodyne character than the Mary King, who's just sitting there having a dinner.
Well, as I said earlier, there's a surprising proportion of Victorian witches, or supposed witches, were family members. Mary King wasn't unusual in that sense, and I think it shows us that, you know, he wasn't just out to stigmatise his grandmother or to sort of slander her. I mean, he genuinely had come to believe that she was a witch. Looking across Victorian witchcraft as a whole, the people that were accused of witchcraft seemed to be people that had quite frequent contact with people who believed they were bewitched and had slightly fraught relations as well. So it could be family members, or it could be, you know, the people who might go begging for a little bit of food if they were out of money. And it's something that's occurred again and again in the Victorian period. And it stopped, not really because people stopped believing in its power or believing in the power of witchcraft, but because policing became much more effective from the mid-19th century. The number of police increased, and basically people couldn't get away with this, and they knew they couldn't get away with it any longer. People started getting arrested more and more, and that's really what put an end to this form council witchcraft.
So I'm just thinking of... But the method, again, it just seems very prescribed, and it's a razor, it's above...
Yeah,
you're saying above the...
Like, yeah, above the breath. Sometimes people didn't do it above the breath. You know, you can imagine, you know, you can plan these things. You can carry your razor, or sometimes people do it with all sorts of horrible things, with a nail or with a knife or something. But, you know, people made these plans, as no doubt Charles had been planning it for weeks. But when they finally got there, in wherever it was, in the house, in the alley, in the market square sometimes... to finally got their hands on their witch, you know, it's quite hard to get someone to stay still while you you know, treat them so well.
There are various methods. I'm going to mention a few that you write in the book, because they're quite lively. There's one book of spells, I suppose they are, which came from the Devon cunning man. I can't remember his name. Maybe you can tell me in a minute. But when he has a potion mixed with a spell. So mix a little of the cow's hair and blood with salt and gunpowder, stuff it in a bladder and incinerate it on a fire made of green ashen wood. As it burns, pronounce these words: I confine all evil and enemies of mine and of my cattle, sorry, this is in relation to cattle, to the fire forever, never to hurt me nor mine forever, in the name of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Amen. And there's another one which it just kind of made me laugh more than anything. It said, bewitched people should also read the first 13 verses of chapter 8 of Deuteronomy every morning, and strictly no more. So you've got various methods here. But at the bottom of it, I suppose we've got quite an appalling incident of domestic violence. But surrounding this is... Shall we move on to our third scene?
Let's
go from London. And we're going to go to Manchester. So is this a little bit later on in the year? I'll let you pick up the story. This is our third scene.
That's right, yes. I thought this is another kind of classic location in Victorian Britain. We're moving to Manchester in August of 1862, and we're going specifically to a suburb of Manchester called Ancoats. And Ancoats is the kind of classic industrial suburb.
I've got to imagine Manchester in the 19th century must have been a sight to behold anyway. What is taking us there on that day, though?
This time we're going to go and look at a fortune teller, at somebody who made their living out of providing magical services, divination, love magic, and also various forms of counter witchcraft, and sometimes even dark magic. And we're going to look at a kind of an encounter gone wrong, really, with a fortune teller and her client. And it's not in rural England. It's not amongst the most sort of impoverished and uneducated people in Victorian England. It's in this, as I say, the sort of epicenter of the Industrial Revolution.
Mary Ann Leake, that's her name.
That's right, yes. Mary Ann Leake was living, according to the newspaper report, in Pollard Street in Ancoats. And I had a look, again, this shows some of the limitations of the newspaper report. Yes, we've gone to the house of Mary Ann Leake in Ancoats, and she's invited another lady round to her house, up to one of the upstairs rooms where just the two of them are. And this other lady is called Alice Vickers, and Alice Vickers is a fortune teller. And this was a good opportunity for a fortune teller like Alice Vickers, who had been working at her, plying her mystical trade in the area for quite some time. But things could go wrong as well for fortune tellers, because technically their work was illegal. Now, it wasn't cracked down on too heavily. If they were going to be prosecuted, it usually relied on their clients actually taking the cases to the police. So if you could keep your client happy, basically, you'd probably be all right as a fortune teller. So she said she was going to tell her fortune, they'd all agreed on that, and the initial cost, as it often was quite low. It was just for a shilling. But then, like some people, at least in this line of work, Alice started to try and, you know, draw out more and more money, as much as she could get from her client. And she said she was going to need over £1, you know, lots of money here, you know, enough to buy the food for the week. I'm going to need £1 from Mary. And if Mary gave her the money, she could predict a fortune, and then she was going to need yet more for the ingredients to carry out the rituals and the conjurations that were necessary. And I suppose Mary must have been pretty unhappy with this, but she agreed with it. But when she started to disagree was with Alice's interpretation of Mary's fortune, because she said something very dark. She said that Mary was going to be destroyed. She was going to be destroyed by none other than her own husband. That there was witchcraft between them, and that the only way Mary could escape was by, in fact, bewitching her own husband and killing him with magic.
Wow, that's awkward.
Yes, it is awkward, and Mary wasn't too pleased about this. Alice told her how to do it. It's a method that I'd not come across, actually, before in the Victorian newspaper archive. I mean, as you were saying, the lore on witchcraft is so rich and varied. There's so many different rituals and practices that people carried out in the realm of magic, but the method that Alice told Mary to undertake was to tread as often as possible on her husband's corns. You know, so tread on his feet. Mary didn't like the sound of this. She didn't like the sound of actually killing her husband with magic. So Alice had sort of intuited, presumably, that they were on bad terms, and that, you know, by going down this line, this would work. She could get some money out. But Mary didn't like this. In fact, she was appalled by this. And this is one of the relatively rare instances where Mary decided to go to the police to report Alice as a fortune teller. And that's why we know about this case, because Alice was taken to the magistrate's court to stand trial.
Well, this is quite intriguing on many levels, isn't it? Because you have this character. Let me check her name again. She's Alice, isn't she?
Yes, fortune teller.
I'm trying to get them the right way around.
Alice Vickers, yeah.
Alice Vickers. But she seems like, as you describe her, to be a likely character, someone who, within a community, there might be someone a bit like her.
Definitely, yes. When a local policeman was asked to give evidence at the trial, and he said, in fact, that Alice had been working as a fortune teller for at least a year in Ancoats, in the local area. So I think that illustrates how this kind of, you know, although it was technically illegal, this work, it was technically, you know, contrary to various
acts. Sounds a bit of a pun, doesn't it, the black economy? But it was that kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
That thing. So she's a likely character, and she's, in a way, what draws you towards this particular story? Has it got a strange conclusion? Is there a twist?
Yes. Well, I think it exemplifies something important about how magic was practiced in Victorian Britain and in the modern period that a lot of people, even people who are fairly well read up on this subject, don't appreciate. In Victorian Britain, as in an earlier period, there were a class of magicians known as cunning folk. Sometimes they were called wise men, wise women, white witches, who were professional magicians. They are known as the people in the historiographical literature, in the history books on this topic. They're known as the people that you went to if you thought you were cursed or bewitched, and that they'd remove it. And in a lot of the writing on this topic, you know, some historians will think that, okay, fortune tellers, they did something different. They just sort of did love magic, or they predicted, you know, are you going to go on a journey or something like that, or who your future husband or wife is going to be. But it actually wasn't the case. Fortune tellers, they were involved in some really dark magic and a wide range of magic. People like Alice Vickers, they offered to remove witchcraft as well in the urban environment. And they even, in some cases, offered to cast witchcraft as well. They offered to sort of lay curses or tell people how to deal in maleficent magic and to harm their own relatives. I think it exemplifies that there are a wide range of people practicing magic and making money out of magic in the Victorian.
So what you're
period.
Describing really to me sounds a bit like the attraction of her is that or her extraordinary quality is that she's actually quite ordinary because she's reflective of a class of people which has maybe been overlooked in the historical record.
I think so. Yes, but it didn't work out for her in this case, and I think it also illustrates the kind of the perils of this occupation.
Mm. So, would one of the attractions for you being there in this moment in Manchester in 1862 would it be just to watch her method
exactly.
of doing business?
Yeah.
Because there's some, I mean, you call them cunning folk,
mm.
which tells you it all, really, doesn't it? I mean, she's quite canny, isn't she? She's got a business to operate, and she's operating it pretty well.
Yes, and I think it'd be a good opportunity if we were there in the room to try and work out, you know, what a client might get out of an encounter and an interaction like this. You know, one can well imagine how Alice benefited just from, you know, getting a reasonable income in a time of depression when work was hard to find in Manchester. But the question is really, why did so many people keep going to fortune tellers and going to cunning folk? Why did people spend large amounts of money on these sort of activities? And that's the kind of thing that I'd really like to know the answer to. And as you may have gathered from reading my book, I think that some of these unwitching rituals, some of the techniques and the conventions that these fortune tellers had, they almost served as like a primitive form of therapy for people, a kind of a cryptic form of therapy, really, for people that were enduring very difficult lives, struggling to deal with a wide range of misfortunes. And basically, these forms of magic were also a form of positive thinking, of externalising the problems, speaking sort of candidly about the problems you were having.
It's really interesting, isn't it, that just how... It's nice to think of the resonances of any story historically of today. I mean, this is one of the chief joys of us as historians, mm. right? And it's this idea of belief. And this is one of the things that you've written about which kind of snagged and I thought about it. And you talk about this idea of magic as a belief system, which I know might be a controversial mm. point of view for some people. But we know now from all of our de-radicalisation programmes and things like that, that actually to change people's beliefs is not an easy thing to do. You can throw money at it, you can hector people, you can abuse them, you can shame them. But
yeah.
It's the one thing that people have which can never really be removed.
Belief's very powerful and underestimated, I think. Unfortunately, belief in everyday language is often used as a synonym for idea or notion. I just have this belief. But in many cases, and certainly in the case of the history of magic, and also in the cases you spoke about, in, you know, more sort of extreme forms of religion, belief is something that's willed. You know, people make themselves believe in these things. They force themselves to believe in these things. That's the whole point of it. They know how unlikely it is and how maybe even irrational it is, or how the evidence goes against it. But people make themselves believe things. And this kind of belief is exceptionally powerful from a psychosomatic and a psychological point of view. You know, we know about the placebo effects. There's also something called the enhanced placebo effect. You really believe something, you can actually get better. There's another phenomenon called the nocebo effect, where if you really believe you're going to get ill, you will get ill. And in the study of witchcraft and magic, there's a more sort of sinister version of the nocebo effect called voodoo death. Voodoo death is the term an American physiologist came up with in the 1940s. And it's the notion that if people really believe that they've been bewitched, if they sincerely think that they're the victim of a malefic spell or a curse, then there'll be a great adrenaline surge in their body. It can give you lesions of the heart, it can damage your gut, it can damage your lungs.
But even at like kind of a very everyday level, for many people who don't really think about witchcraft, apart from maybe going along to the latest Harry Potter movie mm. or something like that, it ripples up, doesn't it? You say, oh, don't jinx it, you know?
Yeah.
You're watching a sporting match, and, you know, you've got to sit in the same place, or everyone has their little superstition. So it does remain in lots of ways.
Yeah, right? There's like a kind of magical version of Pascal's wager where, you know, you might as well just kind of carry out these luck practices because you lose so little by doing it, and you just in case, you know, it's worth doing it.
Okay, well, let me just ask you one last question, which we always ask of every guest. If you were to come back to 2019 with a memento mm. from 1862, is there any particular thing you'd like?
Yes. While we were up on the wee Scottish Isle of Gier, I would have got to know some of the local people, and I would have tried to find out who had a real reputation for being able to deal with magical problems. These people were sometimes known as spaewives in Scotland. And I would have gone to them and asked if they could have created something to protect me from evil powers and magical powers. Because although I'm not superstitious, I have been studying this topic for a long time, and it kind of stays with you. And what I would ask for...
We'll go with the Pascal's wager then.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'd have asked for a very common piece of magical protection, which was a little cross of the rowan tree tied together with red thread. And I think I'd take that home from Scotland. Give the nice person who made it for me, give them a dram of whiskey or a little silver or something, take it home, and it can go in my cabinet with my other good luck charms.
Well, it sounds great to me. We'll certainly let you have that. You did note, actually, during one passage in the book that you've got a few bits and bobs. I like the idea of Amos Grubbs's Bible. Is this in your possession still?
It is, yes.
It opens and closes with the curse, "Steal not this book, my dear friend, for the gallows shall be your end."
It's one for the booksellers there if they need to protect their stock.
Yeah, it'd be quite good. Maybe we should have one for the podcast. "Rate not this podcast with a low starred review, for the devil will come and get you."
Get you, yeah. As long as it rhymes. Very good, yeah, that'll work. The rhyme's important. Yeah.
Has that been officially recognised by our historian of the Dark Arts, Thomas Waters? It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for sharing your story today.
Thank you, Peter.
And so we leave Dr. Thomas Waters holding his cross of rowan wood in the heart of Bloomsbury. For much more, though, his book, Cursed Britain, is the place to go. It's recently been published in hardback by Yale University Press. I'm Peter Moore, and this was Travels Through Time, and thank you very much for listening.
Hello, I'm Artemis. Thank you for listening to this episode of Travels Through Time with Dr. Thomas Waters. The history around magic and witchcraft is such an unusual one, and often very revealing about the nature of that particular time and place, so I really enjoyed this week's episode. Thomas's description of James Smith waking up on his farm to see a potential witch transfigure into a hare and run away across the misty hills was especially haunting. Our next episode will be on the 5th of November, in which the historian Simon Heffer will take us back to the year 1916. Till then, goodbye.
I'm Paul Lay, editor of History Today. You can find more features related to this edition of Travels Through Time at www.historytoday.com/travels-through-time, where Alexandra Walsham looks at the phenomena of apparitions in early modern Europe. Jesse Charles recounts the chilling story of an exorcism performed in an Elizabethan household in Hackney, while Annabel Gregory tells the story of the powerful women who faced trial for witchcraft in 16th and 17th century England. You'll find these and many more stories relating to all aspects of the past every month in History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. To subscribe, visit our website at www.historytoday.com.